You're now tuned in to Cognitive Flow, brought to you by OptimalAnesthesia.com, where clinical insight meets focused clarity. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are really tackling something critical, maybe one of our most important clinical explorations yet, systolic dysfunction.
That's right.
We're going deep into heart failure with reduced ejection fraction, or, you know, HFR, EF.
Really, yeah.
And our mission today really is to get beyond just the clinical guidelines. We want to understand the fundamental molecular science behind why the pump fails.
Absolutely, because if you understand that, you can actually tailor your management for perioperative success. It's not just following a recipe.
Exactly. So this is truly a high-stakes deep dive, isn't it?
It really is. Guiding a patient with HFREF through major surgery successfully, well, it demands a pretty intimate knowledge of that mechanical failure.
We're talking about the heart's impaired ability, specifically the ventricles, mostly the left ventricle, right, to contract and actually eject blood effectively.
Precisely. And if you don't grasp those failure mechanisms, your strategies end up being, well, kind of guesswork. Not the precision we need.
And the number one way we track this, the metric everyone knows, is the ejection fraction, the EF.
The EF, yeah.
Yeah.
It's that ratio, isn't it? Blood injected versus the total volume that was in the ventricle to start with.
So it's the ultimate performance metric for the pump.
You could say that, yeah. Normal, healthy function, we usually think 50-55%.
Okay.
We start getting concerned when it drops into that mild range, say 41-49%.
Right.
Moderate is 30-40%. But once you dip below 30%, that's severe dysfunction. And that's really precarious territory.
And HFREF, the official definition we're working with today, is an EF less than 40%.
Correct. EF 40%.
The clinical urgency here feels, well, profound. As anesthesiologists, think about it. We introduce drugs that depress the myocardium. Almost every single anesthetic agent does this to some degree.
Every single one.
And then we layer on surgery, increased oxygen demand, hormonal chaos, massive fluid shifts. It's a perfect storm for a struggling heart.
And the data backs this up starkly. Major registries show that for patients with an EF under 30% having major non-cardiac surgery, the mortality risk can jump.
Why?
What is it, up to tenfold?
Tenfold. Compared to someone with a healthy heart, the margin for error is just gone.
Vanishingly small.
Yeah.
Non-existent, really.
I like that car engine analogy one of the sources use. It helps make the EF number feel more tangible if the heart's an engine.
Yeah.
How do these numbers play out?
It's a great analogy. Think of EF as horsepower or efficiency. EF 55%. That's your brand new V8 just purring, ready for anything.
Right.
EF 40%. Uh-oh. That engine's sputtering. It might idle okay, but ask it to accelerate or go uphill surgical stress, and it really struggles.
Right.
And then you hit that severe range, say EF 20%.
Yeah.
You're basically running on maybe two cylinders, just barely keeping things moving.
Wow, that really paints a picture. And you mentioned the engine idling okay, but not ready for stress. That connects to that consultant's insight hook, doesn't it? The patient who looks stable, but is actually a ticking time bomb.
Absolutely crucial point. Even patients who seem clinically stable walking in, if they have a very low EF, say 25%, especially if it's combined with a really high BNP.
The B-type natriuretic peptide.
Right, say over 1,000 pg/mL.
Yeah.
These patients can just completely decompensate the second you induce anesthesia.
What? Why does that stability just vanish so quickly?
Because that stability, you see, it's often an illusion. It's maintained by the body throwing everything it has at the problem. Chronic, maximized sympathetic drive, neurohormonal compensation cranked up to 11.
So the body is basically redlining just to keep baseline perfusion.
Exactly. It's running flat out. Then we come along with anesthesia, especially something that vasodilates like propofol or a spinal block. We abruptly pull the rug out from under that sympathetic support system. And the failing pump, suddenly unmasked, reveals its true, profound inadequacy, anticipating that unmasking is, well, it's everything.
Okay, let's unpack this then. Before we jump into OR strategies, we absolutely need the science. What is actually failing inside the heart muscle cell?
Yeah, we have to start with the normal process, the beauty of excitation-contraction coupling.
Right.
So the electrical signal hits the cell membrane, opens L-type calcium channels, a little bit of calcium comes in.
Okay.
That initial trickle triggers this massive release of calcium stored inside the cell in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, or SR. It comes out through these gates called ryanodine receptors, RYR2.
That's the calcium-induced calcium release, CICR.
Exactly, CICR. That flood of calcium binds to the contractile proteins, causing the muscle to contract. Then for relaxation, it's got to be cleaned up fast. The circuit to a pump actively pumps calcium back into the SR.
Requires energy, ATP.
Lots of it. And another mechanism, the sodium-calcium exchanger, or NCX, pushes any remaining calcium out of the cell. It's normally a very rapid, high-fidelity cycle. Beat, relax, beat, relax.
Sounds incredibly precise, but also very energy-hungry. In HFREF, though, that precision is lost. The sources point to three key molecular failures. Let's start with the first one, calcium mishandling.
This is probably the most studied area. We see these three core defects in how calcium is handled. There's a handy mnemonic, RSN.
Yeah. RSN. Okay.
Of course, the RYR2 receptors, those gates for SR calcium release, they become defective, they get leaky.
Leaky-ho!
Well, in chronic heart failure, that constant sympathetic overdrive we mentioned, it floods the system with norepinephrine. This activates protein kinase A, PKA.
Right.
PKA then hyperphosphorylates RYR2, basically jamming the gates slightly open. So calcium constantly leaks out of the SR, even between beats.
So the storage tank is already half empty when the next signal arrives. The contraction trigger is weaker.
Precisely. Less calcium available for release means a weaker contraction. Second defect, the S-circuit-2A pump.
The cleanup crew.
Yeah, the vacuum cleaner. It's downregulated or its activity is impaired, so it's much slower at sucking calcium back into the SR.
Meaninglessly can't relax properly.
Exactly. It contributes to diastolic dysfunction, problems with relaxing and filling on top of the systolic failure. And it means the SR isn't refilled properly for the next beat. Double whammy.
Okay, RS, what's N?
N is the NCX, the sodium-calcium exchanger. This one is upregulated. It starts working overtime, pumping too much calcium out of the cell.
So leaky storage tanks, slow cleanup, and actively throwing fuel overboard. Net result, a weak, disorganized, energy-wasting contraction.
You got it. And here's the direct clinical link. Mm-hmm. Think about massive transfusions.
Citrate.
Exactly. Citrate chelates ionized calcium. In a normal heart, there's some reserve. But in these HFREF hearts already operating on minimal mismanaged calcium, that drop in ionized calcium from citrate can be devastating. It just tanks the remaining output.
So recognizing that RSN pattern immediately tells you, be aggressive with calcium replacement if giving blood products.
Absolutely. It's not just theoretical, it's bedside management.
That's a powerful link. But is it all about calcium? I mean, can the machinery itself just wear out? That brings us to the second failure, actin-myosin dysfunction.
Oh, absolutely. The physical machinery is definitely compromised. Even if you could magically fix the calcium signal, the engine parts are worn. We see reduced efficiency in the cross bridges forming between actin and myosin.
The actual power stroke is weaker.
Weaker and less efficient. And the heart actually starts expressing abnormal myosin isoforms. It shifts from the faster, more energy efficient adult forms back towards slower, less powerful fetal isoforms.
Why would it do that?
It's thought to be a maladaptive attempt to conserve energy. But the trade-off is significantly less pump power.
So back to the car analogy. We fix the fuel line, calcium, but the pistons themselves are maybe the wrong type or just broken.
Good way to put it. Plus, the sensitivity to calcium is reduced. This is due to changes in troponin I phosphorylation. The trigger is there, but the response is blunted.
Which explains why some new drugs aren't focused on calcium.
Exactly. You see novel agents like omecamtiv mecarbil. It's a myosin activator. It tries to directly improve the physical interaction between actin and myosin, essentially bypassing the upstream calcium issues. It's trying to fix the piston system directly.
Fascinating. Okay, third failure, the energy crisis. This feels like where everything converges, right? The final common pathway to collapse.
It really is. The engine running out of fuel. Chronic HFREF is an energy-starved state. The mitochondria, the cell's powerhouses, which should be dense and efficient,
become sparse and dysfunctional.
Correct. And the heart's preferred fuel source is fatty acids, very efficient. But in failure, it shifts towards less efficient glucose metabolism and even worse, anaerobic glycolysis.
Generating lactate even at rest.
Sometimes, yes.
Yeah.
Even before the stress of surgery. It's burning through resources incredibly fast and getting very little ATP bang for its buck.
And ATP depletion is the inevitable result. No energy means
the critical ion pumps start failing. The Na plus Ka plus ATPase, the circa K2 plus ATPase, they all need ATP. Without it, you get ionic chaos, cell swelling, electrical instability.
Just substrate for arrhythmias.
Exactly. Life-threatening arrhythmias. Mm-hmm. And crucially, hypotension in this setting isn't just about low volume. It's often about a fundamental lack of power, an ATP deficit.
Which is why high-dose propofol can be so devastating, it directly hits mitochondrial function.
Precisely. You're pouring water on an already sputtering fire.
Oh.
You administer a drug known to impair mitochondrial function, and you push that heart right over the energetic cliff.
So there's another mnemonic here, MAP.
Yeah, mitochondrial failure, ATP depletion, pump dysfunction. MAP. And the clinical pearl here is huge. If your HFrEF patient is hypotensive and not responding to typical vasopressors,
They might not be fluid responsive or even just need more alpha.
they might be ATP resistant. They literally don't have the energy to respond. They might need metabolic support, maybe inotropes that improve efficiency, or even mechanical support, not just more norepinephrine.
Wow. Okay, these cellular failures then drive the big systemic problem, neurohormonal maladaptation. The body tries to help, but it just digs a hole deeper.
It's the classic vicious cycle. Chronic low cardiac output triggers the kidneys and the brain to scream for help. This maxes out the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, RAAS, and the sympathetic nervous system, SNS.
RAS means fluid retention, vasoconstriction, more preload, more afterload. Bad news for a failing pump.
Terrible news. And the SNS provides that initial vital compensatory squeeze, keeping blood pressure up.
Yeah.
But the cost is enormous.
Which is.
That constant adrenergic overstimulation, it directly damages heart cells, causes apoptosis-programmed cell death, and makes the heart incredibly prone to dangerous arrhythmias. The heart is literally compensating itself towards destruction.
That's, yeah, a tragic summary. And this neurohormonal overdrive is the setup for our biggest anesthetic risk, isn't it?
Absolutely. These patients are dependent on that high sympathetic tone for survival. Then we give anesthesia propofol, sevoflurane, a spinal block, and we suddenly cut that sympathetic input.
Boom! Loss of afterload, loss of preload support.
And the failing ventricle, which has no reserve, simply cannot cope. It collapses. This is precisely why continuing their chronic beta blocker therapy is so vital. It protects the heart muscle from the toxic effects of that relentless sympathetic surge. You need that protection on board.
Okay, so we have a handle on how the heart fails internally. Now, what are the common culprits, the main reasons, the etiologies we see bringing these patients to us preoperatively?
Well, the vast majority of HFrEF cases fall into three main buckets. Number one, by far, is ischemic heart disease, usually from a previous heart attack and MI.
So, dead muscle replaced by scar tissue.
Exactly. Scar tissue doesn't contract, it's mechanically inert. The remaining healthy muscle has to work harder, hypertrophy, compensate, making it very vulnerable to any increase in demand or drop in supply.
So the management focus is crystal clear. Balance oxygen supply and demand.
Absolutely. Avoid tachycardia at all costs. A faster heart rate means less diastolic filling time.
Which is when the coronaries perfuse the heart muscle itself.
Right. Less filling time, less coronary perfusion. And crucially, you must avoid hypotension. Maintaining adequate coronary perfusion pressure, CPP, is non-negotiable.
Which often leads people towards induction choices like.
Often etomidate plus fentanyl. Etomidate is hemodynamically stable, minimal myocardial depression. Fentanyl blunts the sympathetic surge from laryngoscopy and intubation without depressing the heart. It minimizes both demand increase and direct depression.
Okay, second major cause, dilated cardiomyopathy, DCM. This is more of a structural failure, right? The big, floppy, overstretched balloon analogy.
That's the classic picture. The chambers get huge, the walls thin out, and physics tells us this is bad news specifically, Laplace's law.
Right. Remind us why a big ventricle is under more stress than a small one, even at the same pressure.
Laplace's law basically says wall tension, or stress, is proportional to the radius times the pressure. So if the LV radius doubles because it's dilated.
The wall stress doubles just to hold the same pressure.
Exactly. It has to burn twice the ATP just to maintain the status quo. This feeds right back into that energy crisis we discussed. It makes a DCM heart incredibly sensitive to increases in afterload.
Hence the mnemonic dilate.
Yep. Dilated, increased wall stress, low contractility, afterload sensitive, thin walls, ejection fraction low. And that afterload sensitivity is why pure alpha agonists like phenylephrine can be disastrous in DCM.
Got it. Third major cause, hypertensive heart disease. This feels like a slower process.
It often is. Chronic high blood pressure forces the left ventricle to work against high resistance. Initially, it hypertrophies gets thicker, which is compensatory.
But eventually.
Eventually, even that thickened muscle can burn out, dilate, and fail, becomes exhausted. The danger here is that these patients can be insidious. Their EF might still be near normal, maybe 50%.
But they have zero reserve.
Zero reserve, and they are utterly dependent on that high baseline systemic vascular resistance, SVR. Even a mild drop in SSR, maybe from a small dose of propofol or a bit of spinal anesthesia, can cause a catastrophic collapse in blood pressure, even if the EF number itself doesn't look terrible yet.
Okay, moving to the clinical picture, what are the classic symptoms we should recognize? The signs of decompensation.
The standard mnemonic is FLOP, easy to remember. Fatigue from low cardiac output, lung congestion, that's the pulmonary edema, shortness of breath, orthopnea, can't breathe lying flat, and peripheral edema, swollen ankles, legs.
But you flag that crucial consultant's caution. Symptoms don't always track with risk.
Cannot stress this enough. A patient who lives a very sedentary life might not report much fatigue or shortness of breath. But if their echo shows an EF of 25%, they're profoundly high risk regardless of symptoms. They're just compensating at a very low level of demand.
Which is why the objective diagnostics are non-negotiable. Echocardiography.
Our best friend, absolutely. Gives us the EF, shows the structure as a dilated, hypertrophied, wall motion abnormality suggesting ischemia. It's essential.
And then the biomarker we keep mentioning, BNP or NT-proBNP, the check engine light?
Exactly. Released by the ventricle walls when they're stretched under pressure. The mnemonic works. BNP breathes not properly.
And the key insight here?
The key insight, backed by lots of evidence now, is that a preoperative BNP level is often a stronger independent predictor of postoperative heart failure and mortality than the EF alone, especially once it gets really high, say over 1,000 pg/mL. It tells you how much stress that ventricle is under right now, regardless of how the patient feels sitting there.
Okay, let me push on that slightly. If BNP is so predictive, is EF becoming less important? Should we just rely on BNP?
No, not at all. They tell you different complementary things. EF tells you about the pump's current mechanical function. How well is it squeezing right now? BNP tells you about the stress the heart wall is experiencing and reflects chronic remodeling and pressure overload.
So you need both.
You absolutely need both. You need the echo to understand the type of problem. Is it ischemic, dilated, hypertrophic? And you need the BNP to gauge the severity of the stress and the overall prognosis heading into a major stressor like surgery. They work together.
Makes sense. Okay, part three, the operating room strategy. This is where the rubber meets the road, where physiology meets practical management. Let's start before induction, preoperative optimization, and meds.
Right. Step one is risk stratification. Use the tools. EBR. Echo findings, BNP level, and a clinical risk index like the RCRI. And critically, if the patient shows up clinically wet, congested, short of breath, recent decompensation.
Elective surgery is off.
Elective surgery is off until they're optimized, dried out, meds adjusted, stable. You need cardiology input. Don't proceed if they're actively decompensated.
Okay, medication management. This is always tricky. Beta blockers. Standard of care for HFREF, but we get nervous giving anesthetics on top of them. When do we have to hold the beta blocker?
The mantra here is be brave. Continue the beta blocker unless the patient is in truly acute cardiogenic shock, severely hypotensive despite support, or profoundly bradycardic, say heart rate consistently below 50.
Why the push to continue?
Because the risk of withdrawing it is usually much higher. You risk a rebound, sympathetic surge, arrhythmias, even increased mortality. That beta blockade provides crucial protection against the toxic effects of catecholamines during surgical stress. Keep it on board if at all possible.
But ACE inhibitors, ARBs, and the ARNIs, like sacubitril, valsartan, that's a different story, right? We usually hold those.
Generally, yes. They're fantastic long-term drugs for remodeling, but acutely, they significantly increase the risk of refractory hypotension and vasoplegia when combined with anesthesia. The vasodilation can be profound and hard to treat.
So the standard is hold them the morning of surgery.
That's the common practice to mitigate that immediate risk of hemodynamic collapse during induction and maintenance.
But wait a minute. If we hold an ARNI, like sacubitril valsartan, we're not just holding the ARB part. We're losing the neprilysin inhibition too, right? That benefit against harmful neurohormones is gone for potentially 24 hours or more post-op. Isn't that a problem for remodeling?
That is the absolute crux of the debate, the real tightrope walk. Mm-hmm. You are absolutely right. You're trading that short-term hemodynamic stability, avoiding the immediate catastrophic vasoplegia, for losing the longer-term physiological benefits of neprilysin inhibition during the high-stress perioperative period.
So how do we justify that trade-off?
The current consensus leans towards prioritizing immediate safety. The risk of profound refractory hypotension right after induction, potentially leading to cardiovascular collapse, unresponsive to standard pressors, is seen as the more immediate danger that must be mitigated, especially with ARNIs, which are particularly potent vasodilators.
So hold them, get through the acute phase, and restart ASIP post-op.
Exactly. Hold them to reduce the vasoplegia risk, manage hemodynamics carefully, and then get that crucial GDMT, including the ARNI, back on board as soon as the patient is stable enough and can take oral meds. It's an imperfect solution, but generally seen as the safer path for the acute perioperative phase.
Okay. Now for the highest risk moment. Induction. Sympathetic tone drops. Drugs depress the heart. potential for collapse.
It's the moment of truth, absolutely. We need an induction strategy that minimizes myocardial depression and avoids massive vasodilation. This brings us to the KEEP strategy for drug choice.
KEEP, okay, lay out.
K is for ketamine. It can be very useful in patients with low EF who are already hypotensive because it stimulates the sympathetic nervous system, boosting heart rate and blood pressure.
But the big caveat.
The huge caveat. Avoid it in known ischemic heart disease. That sympathetic surge drastically increases myocardial oxygen demand, which can precipitate ischemia or infarction in patients with coronary disease. E is for etomidate. Still widely considered the gold standard for hemodynamically unstable inductions. Minimal effect on contractility. Minimal effect on vascular tone. Very stable.
So check in E.
Every opioid. Meaning, opioids like fentanyl, sufentanil are generally very safe from a cardiac standpoint.
Uh-huh.
They don't depress contractility significantly, and they are excellent for blunting the sympathetic stress response to laryngoscopy and intubation, which is crucial.
And the P, propofol.
Propofol requires extreme precaution. In patients with EF 30%, you really should avoid a standard induction bolus altogether.
So if you have to use it.
If you use it, it needs to be a slow, careful titration. Think 10, 20 milligrams at a time, watching the blood pressure response over minutes, not seconds. Give it time to see the effect before giving more. Any rapid bolus is asking for trouble.
And that consultant's extreme strategy for the really sick ones?
Yeah.
EF 20% with pulmonary hypertension.
Yeah, that's pretty eye-opening. Preferring an opioid benzodiazepine induction, think high-dose fentanyl and midazolam, but with a norepinephrine infusion already running before you even push the induction drugs.
That's anticipatory resuscitation, basically.
Yeah, exactly. You know the SVR is going to plummet when you induce. So you preemptively support it with norepinephrine to maintain perfusion pressure before the collapse happens. You build a safety net before the jump.
Okay, patient is induced, airway secured. Now the ongoing hemodynamic management, that tightrope walk. Let's talk fluids first.
Fluids are tricky. You have to think of them like fine seasoning, not the main dish.
Why?
Because many HFREF patients, especially those with DCM, are actually quite preload dependent to maintain output, but their Frank-Starling curve is very flat at the top and then drops off steeply.
Meaning
a little bit of fluid might help optimize preload and stroke volume, but just a small amount too much can push them right over the edge into pulmonary edema. There's very little room for error.
So we can't just chase urine output or give standard boluses?
Absolutely not. That's dangerous. You need goal-directed fluid therapy, PDFT. Use objective measures. Stroke volume variation, SVV, or pulse pressure variation, PPV, from the arterial line can help if the patient meets the criteria.
But the gold standard?
Ideally, transesophageal echocardiography, TEEs, especially for major cases or very sick patients. One source mentioned a transplant center using TE routinely for inductions in EF 20% patients. They found that as little as 250 milliliters of crystalloid could dramatically worsen cardiac function if given inappropriately.
Wow, 250 millimil, that's tiny.
Tiny volume, huge potential impact. TE lets you see the LV filling in real time and guide fluid administration precisely.
Okay, let's talk vasoactive drugs. You mentioned the big mistake earlier, using phenylephrine. Let's really drill down on why norepinephrine is so much better in severe systolic dysfunction.
This is absolutely critical knowledge. Phenylephrine is a pure alpha-1 agonist. It clamps down hard on peripheral arteries, causing a significant increase in systemic vascular resistance, SVR.
Which sounds good if the blood pressure is low.
It sounds good, but think about the failing heart, especially a dilated one. Suddenly increasing the resistance it has to pump against the afterload is like asking someone with weak legs to suddenly push a much heavier weight.
So the heart struggles.
Massively. The left ventricular end diastolic pressure, LVEDP, skyrockets almost instantly. This backs up pressure into the pulmonary circulation, worsening or causing pulmonary edema. And because the weak ventricle simply cannot overcome that increased resistance, the actual forward flow, the cardiac output, CO, often decreases. The heart muscle is strained, oxygen demand goes up, supply might drop. It's bad news.
Okay, so how is norepinephrine different?
Norepinephrine is more balanced. It has potent alpha-1 effects. Yes, so it raises SVR and blood pressure. But crucially, it also has moderate beta-1 agonist effects.
Meaning it provides some inotropic support, a bit of a squeeze.
Exactly. It gives a gentle boost to contractility. So while it increases afterload via alpha agonism, the beta agonism helps the heart handle that increased load somewhat. The net effect is usually an increase in blood pressure without the detrimental drop in cardiac output you often see with phenylephrine in these patients.
So the rule is clear. Avoid phenylephrine in systolic dysfunction unless the primary problem is truly profound vasoplegia, like in septic shock.
That's the key takeaway. the go-to strategy, the NDML strategy. Norepinephrine first line for pressure support. If the pressure is okay, but the cardiac output is still low, you need TE or advanced monitoring to know this, then you add an inotrope like dobutamine or milrinone or maybe levosimendan in some context for direct output support. Phenylephrine is generally off the table for primary blood pressure support in HFR-EF.
Got it. And monitoring beyond the standard, arterial line is a must, obviously.
Arterial line is non-negotiable. For beat-to-beat blood pressure and for dynamic parameters like SVV, PPV is applicable. The TE, as we said, is the gold standard for complex cases. It gives you direct visualization of volume status, contractility, wall motion, watching for ischemia, and valve function. It's invaluable.
What about anesthetic depth?
Crucial point. Using BIS or processed EEG monitoring is highly recommended. These patients are sensitive to anesthetic overdose, which is a common cause of hypotension. Precisely titrating anesthetic depth helps prevent giving too much drug, which further depresses an already compromised heart.
Okay, surgery's done. Post-operative care, where do these patients need to go?
Absolutely need ICU, or at least a high dependency unit. Close monitoring for 24, 48 hours minimum. The immediate post-op risks are significant. Think MAP again, but for post-op risks. Meticulous fluid monitoring. Watch for arrhythmias. Pain, stress, electrolyte shifts can trigger them. And watch for pulmonary congestion.
And pain control.
Good pain control is vital to reduce sympathetic stress. Regional analgesia epidurals, nerve blocks is highly preferred. Reduces systemic opioid needs, blunts the stress response, but critically, avoid NSAIDs.
Why?
NICE guidelines are very clear on this. NSAID can worsen renal function and cause sodium and water retention, both of which are poison for heart failure patients. Huh? They can tip them right back into decompensation. Stick to acetaminophen, opioids cautiously, and regional techniques.
And getting their home meds back on board.
Essential.
Restart their guideline-directed medical therapy, GDMT, beta blockers, ACI, ARB, SARNA, diuretics as soon as they are hemodynamically stable and able to take oral medications. Early resumption is key to prevent negative remodeling and improve outcomes.
Okay, let's shift to part four, special situations. HFR-EF intersecting with other major physiological challenges. First up, pregnancy and peripartum cardiomyopathy, PPCM.
PPCM is a real crisis situation. You have a patient with newly diagnosed heart failure, dealing with the massive hemodynamic load of pregnancy, that 40-50% increase in plasma volume.
Highly preload sensitive.
Incredibly preload sensitive and very limited ability to handle abrupt changes in SVR. So for delivery, especially C-section, the risk from anesthesia-induced symptectomy is extreme.
So a standard single-shot spinal anesthetic is definitely out.
Absolutely contraindicated, really. Oh. Far too likely to cause profound refractory hypotension. You need a much more controlled approach.
Huh.
A low-dose combined spinal epidural, CSC, where you give a tiny spinal dose and then titrate carefully through the epidural catheter, or just a carefully managed epidural from the start. Slow titration is key.
And after delivery, uterotonics.
Careful management needed there, too. Oxytocin is usually needed, but it must be given as a slow infusion, not a rapid IV bolus. A bolus can cause significant vasodilation and hypotension. And agents like ergometrin, methergine, which can cause severe hypertension and coronary vasospasm, should generally be avoided entirely in these patients. They need mandatory ICU monitoring postpartum.
What about pediatrics? Kids with cardiomyopathy compensate differently, don't they?
Completely different. Unlike adults who can increase stroke volume, pediatric hearts compensate for stress almost entirely by increasing heart rate. Their stroke volume is relatively fixed.
So if their heart rate drops,
their cardiac output plummets disastrously. There's almost no reserve. This makes induction incredibly risky. The consultant rule here is non-negotiable. Have inotropes, usually milrinone or dobutamine, drawn up, labeled, and ready at the bedside before you induce anesthesia in a child with known cardiomyopathy. You cannot afford to wait for the collapse. You need to be ready to treat instantly.
Okay. Non-cardiac emergencies like trauma or sepsis, HFREF meets inflammation and vasoplegia.
Yeah, this is a nightmare scenario. You have the underlying systolic dysfunction, plus you might have septic cardiomyopathy, further depressing function, and you almost certainly have profound vasodilation from the inflammatory response. They crash faster and harder.
So the strategy needs to be aggressive.
Very aggressive. Remember, SAVE. Sepsis means norepinephrine is your first-line pressor. Avoid fluid overload. Be even more cautious than usual. Use vasopressors early and potentially in combination, like adding vasopressin. And use ECHO, bedside TTE or TE, to guide your fluid and pressor therapy dynamically.
The source has highlighted that specific high-risk case. Emergency laparotomy for sepsis in a patient with EF 20%.
That patient is already maximally compensating with endogenous catecholamines. The moment you induce general anesthesia and blunt that sympathetic drive, their pressures are going to crater. The critical insight, again, is proactive support. Starting an norepinephrine infusion before induction is often life-saving. You have to establish adequate SVR support externally before you take away the body's internal support.
Okay, let's tie these concepts together with some quick taste for you. Case vignettes, case one. 65-year-old, known EF, 25%, needs urgent hip fracture surgery, regional versus general. What's the nuanced approach?
This is tough. Full spinal is too risky. Full GA is risky. The best compromise is often a carefully titrated low-dose combined spinal epidural, CSE. You get the excellent pain relief of Neuraxial, but you control the sympathectomy level very gradually using the epidural.
And support.
Absolutely. Have norepinephrine infusion ready, maybe even running at a low dose preemptively. If GA is the only option, it has to be etomidate fentanyl-based, avoiding propofol bolus strictly. Vigilance is key.
Case 2, emergency colectomy for sepsis. Patient has EF 30% and is on an ARNI, sacubitril valsartan.
Okay, alarm bell's ringing. Sepsis plus ARNI equals almost guaranteed refractory vasoplegia. Standard doses of norepinephrine might not be enough.
So the strategy.
Start norepinephrine early, but be prepared to add vasopressin quickly. Vasopressin works via different receptors, V1, and can be effective when adrenergic receptors are saturated or downregulated in sepsis. And keep methylene blue in the back of your mind as a rescue therapy if you encounter profound pressor-refractory vasoplegic shock. It inhibits nitric oxide synthase and guanylate cyclase.
Case 3, weaning from cardiopulmonary bypass after CAG. Patient's pre-op EF was 20%. Pharmacologic support, like norepinephrine, isn't enough to come off pump.
This is common in severe LV dysfunction post-bypass. The ventricle is stunned. First steps are optimizing hemodynamics pharmacologically. Add an inotrope. Dobutamine is common for contractility, or maybe milrinone if you also need pulmonary vasodilation or alkaloid reduction. Levosimendan is another option in some centers.
But if that fails?
If you can't wean despite optimal preload, afterload, rate, rhythm, and strong inotropic support, you have to escalate to mechanical support early. Don't wait too long. Think PAMEI. Preload optimize, afterload balance, medications, inotropes like milrinone, dobutamine, and Levo, then IABP, intra-aortic balloon pump, or even ECMO if necessary. Early mechanical support can be life-saving here. Don't delay.
Okay, we've covered the science, the strategies, the special cases. Let's synthesize. Part 5, prognosis and synthesis. What are the big red flags, the macro signals telling us this patient is actively failing or at extreme risk?
There's a useful checklist mnemonic for these really high-risk prognostic markers. Fail-safe. These are signs that scream danger, high risk of perioperative cardiac events.
Okay, break down fail-safe for us.
F is for falling EF, especially if it's known to be 30% or actively dropping. A is for arrhythmias, particularly significant ventricular arrhythmias like VT or VF, showing electrical instability. A is for increasing BNP. That preoperative level 1,000 pg/mL is a major warning sign. L is for lactate rising intraoperatively, indicating tissue hyperperfusion and that energy crisis we talked about.
Okay, fail. What about safe?
S is for severe pulmonary edema, either pre-existing or developing acutely. A is for acute hypotension that's refractory to standard treatment, suggests profound pump failure or vasoplegia. F is for frequent recent hospital admissions for heart failure decompensation. And E is for evidence of end organ dysfunction, particularly rising creatinine indicating renal hypoperfusion, cardiorenal syndrome.
That's a sobering list. And the consultant summary really hits home. Combine just a few of those, say EF 25% plus pulmonary hypertension plus rising creatinine, and that patient carries a risk profile similar to major cardiac surgery, even if they're only having non-cardiac surgery.
Exactly. The risk is immense, which is why we must integrate the major society guidelines, AHA, ACC, ESC. They all consistently emphasize using BNP&T, pro-BNP for risk stratification. They stress postponing elective surgery if the patient is acutely decompensated.
And resuming GDMT.
Absolutely. The critical importance of resuming guideline-directed medical therapy early postoperatively. And, as we mentioned, the warnings against using NSIs in heart failure patients, the strong guidance from bodies like NICE in the UK as well. Our perioperative plan has to align with these long-term management principles.
So if we boil down this entire deep dive, what are the three absolute pillars of managing HFREF in the perioperative setting for listeners heading into the OR?
Okay, three pillars. One, recognize the high-risk patient. Don't rely on symptoms alone. Use the objective data EF from the echo, BNP levels. Know the risk stratification.
Killer two.
Two, avoid iatrogenic harm. Specifically, minimize anesthetic-induced myocardial depression and vasodilation. Careful drug choice and titration. And strictly avoid volume overload. Use GDFT, use TE if possible. Be conservative.
And pillar three.
Three, use advanced monitoring and precision titration. Have an arterial line. Strongly consider TE for major cases. Use processed EEG. Titrate vasoactive drugs precisely, norepinephrine first for pressure. Appropriate inotropes like dobutamine or milrinone for output if needed. Avoid phenylephrine as a default. Understand the why behind your choices based on the underlying cellular failures.
That's a fantastic summary. This has been an incredibly thorough journey, really connecting the deep science to practical, high-fidelity clinical practice.
You know, the ultimate measure of success in managing these patients is anticipation. It really is like conducting an orchestra where some instruments are badly damaged.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just react to mistakes. You have to anticipate every potential problem. Success demands that every cue, every beat, every drug dose is deliberate and precise based on understanding exactly what's broken at the cellular level.
Mm-hmm.
We have to prevent the crisis, not just react to it.
A perfect closing thought, precision and anticipation. Thanks for joining us on today's episode of Optimal Anesthesia. For in-depth notes, visuals, and bonus content, head over to optimalanesthesia.com. And if you're looking for exclusive podcasts, early releases, and deeper clinical insights, you'll find all that at patreon.com/morphor/anesthesia by Rennie. Support the learning, support the craft. See you in the next one.